This is Kirk Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service with another edition of Did You Know?
This is Farah Tolleson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's program has some more stories about people and stories of North Carolina.
This is Bob Martin, and I'm sure glad I didn't move into that place I told you about last week.
What place was that?
Well, that one that had the sign out in front that said, "If you lived here, you'd be home by now." Boy, what a mess that was. With no keys not fitting and strange people and what I thought was supposed to be my home, I sure learned something from that experience.
Okay, what did you learn?
Well, I learned you just can't trust signs.
So, what happened now?
Well, 2 days ago I was driving down the road and I saw a sign. It said, I couldn't believe this, listen, self-storage.
Bob, lots of places have those signs. It's just a place to keep things you don't have room for at home.
Oh, au contraire, mon frère.
Are you studying a foreign language?
Yeah, I bought one of those Blarney stones.
I think that's Rosetta Stone.
Really? It sure is a funny way to spell it. Well, anyway, right under where it said self-storage, it also said wine storage, you see? Nobody would keep their wine miles away from where they lived. It's an invitation to move in with your wine.
Bob, I don't think that's what they meant.
Oh, sure. Think of the swell theme parties you could throw. Under the Star with Pinot Noir, or It's Saturday with Chardonnay. Something French. You notice I parlez-vous français.
Au contraire, mon frère.
Oh, you too. Well, anyway, after I moved in, I'd throw a party. How's this for my French theme? Stop by friends for a blueberry crepe and a nice 53 Chateau Neuf de Pape. What do you think?
Burma shave.
What?
Hey, Bob, do they have a fence around the place?
Well, of course.
And what do you think that fence is for?
To keep beer drinkers out? Well, you know how they are.
No, it's just to keep everyone out who doesn't have things stored there. The spaces aren't meant to live in. They're meant to put things into and then lock up to keep them safe.
But the sign said self-storage.
It doesn't mean to store you. It means you store your things by yourself.
Oh, well, maybe they need a different sign.
Like?
Well, like a... If you lived here, you'd be home now, and your things would be right next door.
On a previous edition of Did You Know, we presented some famous and interesting people of North Carolina. We came across some more that we'd like to tell you about. And the first two stories might be a bit surprising to you. We told the story of the world-famous Siamese twins, Chang and Eng Bunker, who settled in White Plains, a short distance from Mount Airy, married two local sisters, and raised 21 children. But did you know there are two other sets of conjoined twins who are associated with North Carolina? I didn't.
Neither did I. The first were twin girls, Daisy and Violet Hilton. They were born in Brighton, England on February 5, 1908. Their mother was a single barmaid named Kate Skinner. Kate's boss, one Mary Hilton, assisted at the delivery and apparently saw commercial possibilities with the pair. So, in effect, she bought them from their mother and gave them her last name.
Now, according to the girl's autobiography, Mary Hilton, her husband and daughter, kept the girls under strict control with physical abuse and taught the girls singing and dancing. They began touring England when the girls were three, under the stage name of the United Twins. As the girls grew older, they also toured Germany, Australia, and the United States. In true sideshow tradition, their appearance was accompanied by an imaginative history. And also, as is too often the case, the handlers kept all the money. By 1926, they had developed a tap dance routine and had actually performed with Bob Hope.
When Mary Hilton died in Birmingham, Alabama, Mary's daughter and her husband took over, and they moved to San Antonio, where they began training the girls in jazz music. In 1931, Violet and Daisy gathered the courage to sue their managers and were awarded damages and their freedom. They left the sideshows and turned to vaudeville as the Hilton Sisters Review.
Their personal lives never came together. They suffered through several affairs, failed attempts at getting a marriage license, and a couple of failed short marriages. In 1932, the girls appeared as themselves in the movie Freaks. and in 1951 in Chained for Life. In 1960, The Freaks was reissued and became a classic. This brought them many personal appearances, tours, and cities where the movie was playing.
One of those appearances was at a drive-in movie theater in Charlotte, North Carolina. After the show, their manager gathered up the receipts and left, leaving the girls with nothing and nowhere to go. A good Samaritan came to their rescue. The manager of a local park-and-shop grocery store gave them a job. One girl ran the cash register, and the other bagged groceries. They stayed at this job until they died on January 6, 1969. They are buried in Charlotte's Forest Lawn Cemetery.
The other set of conjoined twins are North Carolina natives Millie Christine McCoy. They were born to slave parents in 1851 in Welch's Creek, Columbus County. According to a document filed at the county courthouse, they were bargained, sold, and delivered from the slave owner, Jabez McKay, to John Purvis of South Carolina for $1,000 and a share of the profits for displaying them.
It is believed the girls' family adopted a form of their owner's name, McKay, and changed it to McCoy. Then, starting when they were about 10 months old, they went on the road and on exhibition. According to legal documents, Purvis had the right to take the children on the road and shall cause the said twin girls to be exhibited for pay at such times and places as he or they shall designate. And the girl's mother, Monomia McCoy, was allowed to go with and accompany the girls without charge for her services so long as the said John C. Purvis shall keep or wish to exhibit the said twin girls.
Sure sounds like a cold way for treating human beings.
According to the law, they weren't people. They were property. Anyway, they were toured across New England and Canada and were billed as the African Twins.
Sometime after 1853, Purvis sold them to a man named Brower, who exhibited them at the State Fair in Raleigh. Then, without their mother, he took them across the South and to New Orleans, where he lost them to a con man, and they disappeared for a while. Somehow, in ways not known, their mother found them, and they came back home.
Following their emancipation, they were well prepared to follow an entertainment career and build themselves as the Two-Headed Nightingale. They even ended up touring with Chang and Eng for a while. They were able to accumulate enough money for themselves to buy a large house on the site of where they had been born in Welch's Creek. In between their tours, they spent their free time in this home.
Unlike the Eng and Hilton twins, the McCoy girls never seemed to have developed separate identities. They were known as the Two-Headed Nightingale, or the Girl with Two Heads. Their name was hyphenated, Millie Christine. Millie died of tuberculosis on October 8, 1912, and Christine died the next day. The state erected a historical marker off Red Hill Road at U.S. 74-76, and that, along with the stone marker on their grave, is all that remains as a remembrance of them.
Two other sets of conjoined twins, along with Chang and Eng, are a part of North Carolina history.
Did you know of the North Carolina native who became famous without saying a word? Anna McNeil was born in Wilmington in 1804. In 1831, she married a civil engineer and former Army officer, George Washington Whistler. Her husband accepted a job in Russia as a railway engineer between Moscow and St. Petersburg. One of her sons, James, became interested in art and was sent to the Imperial Academy in St. Petersburg at age 11.
In 1846, George died of cholera, and Anna and two children returned to live in Connecticut. A daughter married a surgeon and remained in England. One son, William, became a surgeon for the Confederate Army during the Civil War. James attended West Point for a while, but was expelled and left to study painting in France and England. Being from the South and with a son who had been a Confederate surgeon, living was tough in the United States, so Anna left for England and lived there with her son.
Now comes a part that makes her famous. According to one story, James, the artist, had an appointment with a client one day. The client failed to show up. He asked his mother to substitute, and she agreed. According to another story, he initially wanted to paint her standing, but she couldn't stand for long, so she was seated. The finished painting was entitled An Arrangement in Gray and White, but became more popularly known as Whistler's Mother. And it now hangs in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. Not bad for a North Carolina native who became famous while having to say a word.
Did you know that the inventor of the Gatling gun came from North Carolina? Richard Gatling was born in Maney's Neck in Hertford County. He was the son of a plantation owner and was always fiddling with things, trying to make them work a little easier. He came up with a cotton seed sowing machine, a machine for thinning cotton plants in the field, a screw propeller, a rice sowing machine, a hemp processing machine, and a steam plow, all of which increased efficiency on the plantation.
Once he was traveling to Philadelphia by boat when the boat became icebound. Unfortunately, while they were waiting for a thaw, Richard was stricken with smallpox with no doctor on board. He recovered, but afterwards he enrolled in a medical school in Cincinnati. The reason? He never wanted to be helpless again in a medical emergency. Following his graduation, he started thinking about the number of casualties on the battlefield and reasoned that an automatic type of weapon might reduce the need for soldiers and therefore lower the number of injured. He applied some of his ideas from the cotton seed machine and came up with a gun that had a rotating barrel and a gravity-fed loading mechanism.
In 1862, he was granted a patent, and although not yet authorized by the military, it was used by the North in the James River Campaign in 1864. Ironically, a man sworn to save lives with an idea for a gun that might prevent so many lives being lost became the inventor of one of the most deadly killing machines of its day.
Did you know that George A. Cock became known as North Carolina's education governor? That's not too difficult to understand. We just look at the record of his accomplishments. But did you know how it came about to start with? George was born in Fremont in Wayne County in 1859. He was the youngest of 10 children. While still a youngster, he witnessed something that changed his life. One day the county squire came by, needing the mother's signature on a land deed. Much to George's surprise, his mother simply put an X where the signature was required. Later, his mother admitted to him that she could neither read nor write. He vowed to himself that one day he would do something to make sure that every person in North Carolina would have the chance to read and write.
Because of the Civil War, Charles did not begin school until he was 8, but that did not dissuade him. By the time he was 16, he was a teacher in a little one-room schoolhouse. In 1877, he attended the University of North Carolina and graduated in 3 years. In 1881, he was elected superintendent of public instruction for Wayne County. He was elected governor in 1901 and served until 1905. During his term, a schoolhouse was built every day that he was governor.
After his term, he traveled from Maine to Oklahoma, speaking of the importance of education. It was during such travels that he suffered a heart attack and died in 1912. He had a statue placed in Statuary Hall in Washington honoring the best of North Carolina, and his home in Fremont became designated as a state historical monument. All that accomplishment arising not from some huge event, but by simply seeing a mark that his mother made on a piece of paper.
Did you know some important facts about North Carolina during the War for Independence? We had our own Paul Revere. In May of 1775, 27 delegates met at the Charlotte Courthouse and voted to declare Mecklenburg County independent from Great Britain. Captain James Jack took the job of carrying copies of the Declaration to the President of the Continental Congress. He began the trip on May 20th and arrived in Philadelphia on June 23rd.
The Congress was making plans to send a joint statement to the Crown, some still hoping for reconciliation, so denied Mecklenburg's request. Jax made a statement to the assemblage. Gentlemen, you may debate here about reconciliation, but bear in mind, Mecklenburg owes no allegiance to and is separated from the Crown of Great Britain forever. Over a year before the rest of the colonies, Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, made its stand.
And the ladies were not going to be left sitting. On October 26, 1774, the ladies of Edenton and 5 nearby counties met for tea and wrote a declaration against the high taxes levied by Britain against American colonists. News of the ladies' protest and the document arrived in England and was printed in the Morning Chronicle and London Advertiser. The newspaper severely took them to task.
Why not? They were challenging the government.
But that's not why they were criticized. The editorials voiced disapproval of women becoming involved in politics.
Bad move. Back home, citizens of the Carolinas and Georgia rallied behind the ladies, and a boycott against tea drinking was declared. As a result, casks piled up in the storage of Charleston. When war broke out, patrons seized the tea and sold it to help pay for the war effort.
Did you know of the effort of the Overmountain Men? By mid-1780, the Continental Army was demoralized. After losses at Cowpens and Waxhaws, the city of Charleston was surrendered on May 12, 1780. Only North Carolina stood in the way of Cornwallis reaching Virginia.
The Mountain Men of Western Carolina heeded the call to arms. They were mostly farmers and trappers and hunters with no military experience, but they came, in a word, fighting mad. So undisciplined were they that the British referred to them as mongrels. The Brits threatened that if the Americans did not submit, they would lay waste to the land by fire and sword.
Not our land, you don't. Their ranks began to swell. Civilian soldiers from southern Virginia, Tennessee, Georgia, and Kentucky, including Dan'l Boone, marched hundreds of miles to join the Carolina Boys. Engagement began in mid-September 1780 and culminated at Kings Mountain, when they met the British under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Ferguson.
It was a one-day battle, October 7, 1780. The mongrels so badly defeated the British that not one royal soldier was able to escape from the battlefield. That effectively halted Cornwallis's plan for the time being, but he started planning again for an assault on North Carolina. This led up to a battle which, some may say, the mongrels lost, but which eventually won the war.
By January 1871, Cornwallis was again on the move through North Carolina. The decisive battle was fought at Guilford's Courthouse in Martinsboro. Though technically the British were the victors, they lost one-fourth of their men. The Confederates, under Nathanael Greene, then set a series of interfering tactics that drew the British away from their supplies. The culmination came in October 1781, when Cornwallis met and was defeated by George Washington in Yorktown. That effectively ended the war, which might not have happened if it had not been for those mongrels from North Carolina.
Did you know that Martinsboro was renamed Greensboro in honor of Nathanael Greene? And did you know that every year there is a reenactment of the Battle of Kings Mountain at Boone? And did you know that, personally, I'm glad Chapel Hill didn't end up as the UNC Mongrels?
Mm-hmm. Did you know that at the same time the Wright brothers were experimenting at Killdevil Hills, William Luther Paul from Core Sound in Carteret County was also working on flight. His experiment was with a helicopter he called the Bumblebee. He claimed that he'd been able to achieve a lift of 5 feet carrying 60 pounds of ballast. But that was by himself in his garage. His wife's concern for his safety plus a lack of funds forced him to give up his experiments.
Did you know that during the 1824 presidential campaign, Henry Clay came to Raleigh and gave a speech under the shade of a large oak tree? As a part of that campaign, he wrote his famous Texas letter. He was against the annexation of Texas and stated that if Texas were taken into the Union, we would be at war with Mexico. His advisors warned him not to send it because it would cost him the presidency. He responded, "I'd rather be right than president."
Turns out he was right about Texas. Texas was annexed, and soon after, we were at war with Mexico. And he lost the election to James Polk, a North Carolina native.
Did you know about the Tar Heel that saved Washington? That Tar Heel was Dolly Madison, and the Washington was the portrait of George Washington that hung in the White House. During the War of 1812, the British were invading Washington, D.C., and were intent on burning down the White House, which they did in 1814. With little time to rescue belongings, the only North Carolina lady to serve as First Lady, Dolly Madison of Guilford County, ordered the frame broken and took the painting of George Washington to save it from the fire. That picture now hangs, not in the White House, that one is a replica, but in the Smithsonian. And did you know there is an exhibit of Dolly Madison's accomplishments at the Historical Museum in Greensboro?
Did you know of the man who created the Cherokee written language? George Gist was the son of a Cherokee woman and a Virginia fur trader. He was hunting in North Carolina area when he got injured. The hunting accident forced him into a period of inactivity. During this time, he became interested in the way that white people could communicate through letters. He called them talking leaves. He set about doing the same for the Cherokee people. For 10 years, he worked to create an 85-character syllabary. That is, characters that represented syllables rather than letters. His project was adopted by the Cherokee Nation in 1821 and became the basis by which the history of the Cherokee people was saved in writing.
Did you know that just a few years after the creation of this written language, the Cherokees of North Carolina were a part of the tragedy that is known as the Trail of Tears? It started with the Indian Removal Act of 1830, which relocated members of the Chickasaw, Cherokee, Choctaw, Muscogee Creek, and Seminole Nations to other territories. It is estimated that over 4,000 Native Americans perished along the way. And the result? 25 million acres of lands was opened to white settlers. I have another story for you. It's a piece of inside history, but the only reporter to have recorded it was Louis Grassard. Now, it didn't happen in North Carolina, but close by. It seems that after Sherman had taken Atlanta, he was marching out I-75 towards Savannah when he noticed, up on top of a hillside, one lone Confederate soldier waving his arms and cussing after the Yankee troops. Well, Sherman couldn't have this. There was pride at stake. So he sent a soldier up to take care of that loudmouthed Reb. The soldier never came back. But the lone Confederate soldier continued to berate the Federals. This time Sherman sent up 10 soldiers. None of them returned, and the hollering got louder. Sherman next sent up a whole platoon with orders to silence that blankety-blank no matter what it took. None of them returned. And now that lone Confederate soldier was near deranged, hopping up and down and screaming names at Sherman that would have made the horses blush. Needless to say, Sherman was himself becoming near apoplectic. He took 150 of his fiercest troops and ordered them to get up there and bring silence to the world right now. Up that hill they charged, over the top and out of sight. About a half an hour later, one Union soldier came limping back, bruised and bloody and generally just all beat up. Sherman yelled at him, "What in tarnation is going on up there?" The poor soldier was all but crying, "Sir, it's a trap. There's 2 of them up there." And that's a true story. It really happened.
Here are some other stories that really happened. They are about some of the other noted people that call North Carolina home. We have an astronaut, Curtis Brown from Elizabethtown. He is a veteran of 6 space flights and has logged almost 1,400 hours of space travel.
We have some noted journalists that are Tar Heels, David Brinkley and Charles Kowalt from Wilmington and Edward R. Morrill of Polecat Creek.
We have musicians, John Coltrane from Hamlet, Rick Dees, the DJ, from Greensboro, Roberta Flack from Black Mountain, Thelonious Monk of Rocky Mount, and Doc Watson from Boone.
Did you know Cecil B. DeMille, the epic filmmaker, came from Washington, North Carolina, and Ava Gardner from Smithfield, and Andy Griffith from Mount Airy?
Announcer Howard Cosell came from Winston-Salem, and great Harlem Globetrotter Meadowlark Lemon came from Wilmington.
Although they were not originally from North Carolina, we had 3 men's basketball coaches that are to be remembered. Jim Valvano of North Carolina State, partly for his winning the 1983 NCAA tournament, but more for his image and help for cancer research.
Dean Smith, 36 years at UNC, 879 wins, 11 times to the Final Four, and twice NCAA champions. Off the court, he had the record of graduating 96.6% of his players, recruiting the university's first African-American scholarship player, and using his influence to achieve equal treatment of all players by local businesses.
And Mike Krzyzewski, coach of Duke since 1980, 11 Final Four appearances and 4 times NCAA champion. On February 13, 2010, he coached his 1,000th game at Duke on his way to winning the 2010 national championship.
Not bad for a state that has the 2nd most paved highways in the country. According to the North Carolina Department of Transportation, 80,000 miles, 2nd only to Texas.
And they might have needed one of those roads to get to the gold strike. How did you like that segue?
Ooh.
Did you know a former Hessian soldier, John Reed, had a farm in Cabarrus County? One day in 1799, his young son Conrad was playing down at Little Meadow Creek when he saw an interesting rock. He brought it home, and for 3 years it served as a doorstop.
Finally, John became curious about his doorstop and took it to a local jeweler. John had a 17-pound gold nugget, the first documented gold find in the United States. Not knowing anything about gold, he sold it for $3.50. Later, when he realized his naivety, he began studying about gold, and in 1803 started a small gold mining operation.
He started a small mining operation in 1803, started a bigger underground operation in 1831, and when he died in 1845, he was a rich man. The Reed Mine is now an historic site and open to the public, and all because his son brought home a rock for a doorstep.
You know, that reminded me of a story that once happened to my uncle in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
I thought we were telling stories about people in and around North Carolina.
Well, my uncle moved around a lot. He used to be the manager of a fancy hotel in Belgrade. He used to, but not anymore. In fact, the hotel isn't even in Yugoslavia anymore.
Was it destroyed?
I don't know. Maybe the hotel is still there, but Yugoslavia isn't.
That's right. After the wars in the 1990s, Yugoslavia split up into separate countries. Did you know there are now 7 countries that have been formed out of the old Yugoslavia? Bosnia-Herzegovina, Croatia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Slovenia.
Kurt.
Sorry, I was just explaining why he's not managing the hotel in Yugoslavia anymore.
Well, thank you. Anyway, it was 1992, and she was having a terrible time. She wrote me a letter all about it. There was this kitchen worker named Jimmy, who just cracked corn all day long, and he didn't care. On top of that, she had recently married a man named Wally, and she thought Wally was going to be a big help. Well, he wasn't. He just stood around and drew little cartoons all over everything. Now, that's a true story. Polly's Wally doodled all the day.
That was a terrible time he was having.
Oh, no, I'm getting to that. In the middle of this big mess, who do you think shows up? Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer. And what do you think they want to do?
Play chess.
Were you there, too?
No, that's what Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer do. They play chess.
Hmm. And they went all the way to Yugoslavia to do it. Now, she has to set up this chess table right in the middle of the lobby. It had to be in the lobby because there were all kinds of people standing around just watching. Now, Polly can't get too mad because they've booked up all the rooms and the restaurant was full, although nobody was using the golf course, which was strange.
Hey, Bob, what about the people?
What people?
The people standing around watching the chess game.
Ha! Funny you should ask. They were looking at one another and going, shh, 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 shh. It was weird. Then one day, I think it was Thursday, that's the day they closed the swimming pool for cleaning, right in the middle of the chess game, a fight breaks out. These two guys, Spassky and Fischer, got into a knockdown fist fight right in the middle of the lobby. There were chairs knocked down, chess pieces flying through the air, and people screaming, while these two greatest chess players in the world are rolling around on the ground, pulling their hair, jabbing eyes, generally beating up each other right in the middle of the lobby. Well, Wally doesn't do a thing. Jimmy shrugs his shoulders and walks away. My uncle comes running up and grabs these two guys by the back of their collars, yanks them apart, and then hollers at them. Here, here! I will not have chestnuts roistering in the open foyer. And that really happened.
I think it's bell time. Did you know that in Salvo, an unincorporated area of Dare County, sits the smallest post office in the country? It is 8 feet by 12 feet. The smallest is in Ochepe, Florida, at 7 feet by 8 feet.
Did you know that one of the most photographed railroad stations is in the little town of Hamlet in Richmond County? It is now a railroad museum.
There was a U.S. Senator from Morganton who presided over the Nixon Watergate hearings, Sam Irwin.
Did you know who was the first woman to be appointed postmistress? Sarah DeCrow, in 1792 in Hertford, Perquimans County.
There was a law passed in Davie County in 1866 that prohibited riding a horse inside the courthouse.
That the youngest county in North Carolina is Avery, created in 1911.
The North Carolina state motto is Esse Quam Videre, to be rather than to seem.
That the state legislature chartered the University of North Carolina in 1789, making it the first state university in the country.
Did you know what three representatives of North Carolina signed the Declaration of Independence? William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, and John Penn.
What courthouse is the oldest still in use? In Edenton, the Chowan County Courthouse, built in 1767.
That Elizabeth Blackwell, a teacher from Asheville, became the first woman in the country to earn a medical degree. She graduated in January of 1849 from Geneva Medical School in New York.
That Milton Hines was born in Franklinton. He's better known as Soupy Sales.
The largest Civil War battle site in North Carolina is in Bentonville in Johnston County.
The first casualty of the Civil War was Henry Wyatt in 1861 at the Battle of Big Bethel. And did you know that 25% of all casualties from the Civil War were from North Carolina?
Did you know that slang for coffee, a cup of joe, supposedly came from North Carolina native Josephus Daniels, the Secretary of the Navy, who, in 1914, issued a directive banning alcohol from all naval vessels?
For a change of pace, did you know that surfing was once considered a part of the religious tradition? From the sounds of the Beach Boys, it might sound like surfing began in the 1960s, but Hawaiians have been doing it for over 1,500 years. The early Hawaiian word for surfing meant something akin to meditation. In the island mythology, the ancient gods were said to have surfed in celestial waves, which was imitated by the natives as a way of coasting quickly across the coral reefs.
During most of the year, there was a law that restricted certain beaches and reefs for the use of high-ranking dignitaries. But once a year, there was a festival which marked the return of the god Lono. Lono was the god who replenished the earth. During this festival, everyone participated in the activity as their part of welcoming back the god. It was during one such festival that Captain Cook arrived and viewed the sport.
After that, surfing went into a decline for two reasons. One was that whalers and sandalwood traders brought new colonists to the island. And second, some of those colonists were missionaries who considered surfing frivolous and, therefore, sinful. Why frivolous? Because when people surfed, they weren't working. Apparently, the early missionaries believed that God didn't like you to stop working and have fun.
And why was it immoral? Because it brought men and women together without restraint at all times of the day and night, and who knows where that kind of activity might lead. Besides, look at what they wore or didn't wear. All that bare skin? God doesn't approve of that either.
So in the 1820s, the missionaries introduced the Mother Hubbard dress, which evolved into the muumuu. Today, muumuus are just comfortable. Back in the 1820s in Hawaii, it was a whole different story.
In spite of the missionaries' objections, surfing lived on and was revived by a group of teenagers at Waikiki Beach in 1905, and they didn't wear muumuus while surfing.
When all else goes wrong, blame the kids.
You can't always blame the kids. Sometimes they're just playing games. How's that for a segue into one of the most popular board games ever played?
Well, that's got to be Monopoly.
And I remember reading how it was created. In the 1930s, an unemployed boiler salesman named Charles Darrell tried a new way to make a living. One night, he sat down at his kitchen table and sketched out a city plot where he had street names taken from Atlantic City, New Jersey. He had rules for traveling around the board and collecting properties. He sold the game to the Parker Brothers and went on to become a millionaire from the invention of Monopoly.
You did read that, but that's not exactly the way it happened.
You mean Darrow didn't invent Monopoly?
At least not in the way you've usually heard. In 1903, a Quaker, Elizabeth McGee, was living in Maryland. She invented a board game named the Landlord's Game. There were banks, railroads, utilities, a jail, and even Mother Earth at one of the corners.
Although this game is considered to be the granddaddy of Monopoly, the object of the game was entirely different. McGee was committed to a single federal tax designed to discourage property speculation. She was trying to show how rents impoverished poor people while enriching landlords. McGee received a patent for her game in 1904, and the game was published by the Economic Game Company of New York in 1910.
In 1924, she repatented a modified version of the game. This one included street names, some taken from streets in Chicago. There was some commercial distribution, but most of it was popularly spread by word of mouth. It was played in various home versions by Quakers and, did you know, by university students in economic departments.
Now, to the next stage. Enter Charles Darrow. In the early 1930s, Darrow and his wife used to play a version of McGee's Game that was modified for streets in Atlantic City. Supposedly, the modifications were made by friends of Darrow, a family by the name of Todd. As the Depression spread, Darrow became unemployed and looked for a new way to support his family. He wrote down the rules of the game, basically as he had gotten them from the Todds, and then marketed it to Parker Brothers. They bought the rights to the game in 1935.
After Darrow's death, copyright problems arose and Parker Brothers paid McGee $500 and bought her rights to the Landlord's Game. They also promised to release her version of the game, exactly as she intended it to be played. They did this as promised, and the result? If you want a game to teach economy and the value of careful home living, failure. Have you ever heard of the Landlord's Game?
Not before now.
Thank you. But if you want a game that rewards greed and cornering the market so that nobody can move without paying you, Monopoly. Still going strong after 70 years.
Now don't get us wrong. We have all played the game and we all love it.
Hotels on every property and they're all mine.
And here you are.
Did you know that the name of the figure pictured on the Monopoly games is Rich Uncle Pennybags?
We've got some Darwin Award stories for you today. See if you can guess which are true Darwin winners and which of the stories is an urban legend. The first story comes from Virginia. Jim's mother was getting on in years, and the years were telling on her driving ability. Telling, that is, to everyone but Jim's mother. She was adamant that she was still a good driver, better than some of her kids who went speeding around, and she was not about to give up her license. The best possible solution seemed to be to just wait a couple of weeks to when she was going to have her driver's license renewed. This time, it was going to entail a behind-the-wheel test. Great idea. The kids didn't have to be the ogres. Let the DMV tell her no more driving.
The day of the test arrived, and Jim volunteers to take Mother down to the DMV office. It was a nice sunny day, and Jim escorts Mom to the car, holds the door for her, and makes sure she has her seatbelt buckled. Then he steps back behind the car and stands next to the brick wall. You heard me right. Behind the car. 10 feet behind. The examiner gets in the car and tells her to start. Mother starts the engine, steps on the gas, and accidentally pulls the car into gear. Any guesses as to which gear she engages? Everyone guess, right? Reverse. You're all right. Mother was fine. However, the examiner suffered a broken arm, and Jim managed to survive for 2 days. 2 awards given. Jim for where he stood, and so removing himself from the gene pool, and Mother is given an assist.
Well, that's my choice as the urban legend. If Mother was that determined to keep her license, she would have driven herself to the exam.
Too soon to vote, Bob. Listen to the other stories first.
Okay.
Here's the story that involves a man from Vermont visiting in Russia. He was a part of a group of actors from St. Petersburg who were visiting the Eagle Rock African Safari Zoo. This was the kind of zoo where the animals were used to the people, and so they were all in there together, sort of like a great big petting zoo. Now, during his visit, Ronald, the visitor from Vermont, had been bragging all about the wonderful and, to the Russians, seemingly impossible products available in America. One of them was crazy glue. They had a bit of a trouble believing a substance that stuck instantly and firmly. So, Ronald proceeded to give them a demonstration. He squirted a layer of the glue on his hands and then, I'm sure at least to himself, saying, "Hey, watch this," slapped them on the rear end of a rhinoceros that happened to be passing by.
At first, the rhinoceros, a veteran of 13 years at the petting zoo, ignored Ronald. Then, as he began getting the feeling that this was not just a passing fancy, he began to exhibit the kind of behavior for which they took back his credit card. Overcharging. In other words, he threw a fit. In the ensuing minutes, Sally, well, you can't have a rhinoceros on a rampage without giving it a name, Sally smashed into and destroyed 2 sheds, releasing squabblings of small animals, of which 3 pygmy goats and a duck were exited from the gene pool. The animals didn't receive a Darwin Award because they hadn't done anything stupid. Long ago, natural selection had relegated that behavior to humans.
Finally, the keepers were able to subdue Sally. Enter stage two. For the past few days, Sally had been feeling a bit peevish, digestive-wise. That means she was constipated. So the keepers had given her a goodly-sized dose of laxative, which decided to take effect right about now. If the question be asked, who be in deep doo-doo, the answer is Ronald Doo-Doo.
The keepers were finally able to sedate Sally, and they began to work to unstick the glue. And while they worked at that job, three other keepers with shovels worked to keep an air passage open for Ronald. Even though there is no warning label on the box, be here warned. Unconsciousness does not inhibit the effectiveness of X-Lax. The keepers were able, finally, to disengage Ronald from Sally.
Needless to say, the Russians were impressed with Yankee ingenuity. Though Ronald didn't die as a result of this encounter, a Darwin Award was granted on the basis of, well, what were his chances of adding to the gene pool following his personal type of aromatherapy?
Well, what do you think so far?
That's it. That last one. That's the urban legend. If it were a true story, he would have said, hey, watch this. He wouldn't have just suggested that he'd said it.
Well, just wait. There's yet one more story.
Okay. And I'll start this one. Two maintenance workers for a small California school district were presented with a captured gopher. Apparently, not having watched Caddyshack and learned of the resiliency of gophers, they took it back to room and decided to expedite its retirement from the local lawns.
They decided to do this by spraying the gopher with a solvent that was meant to make it easier to remove chewing gum. They had cans of this stuff, since it seems they had more of a problem with chewing gum than with gophers. After three cans, with seemingly little effect, one of them lit a cigarette. This produced a great effect.
The result of the combination of gum removal solvent and the sulfur magnesium compound from the Chem 1A experiment failed to affect the gopher at all. However, it did injure the janitor and the two maintenance worker chemists, and disrupt an adjoining class of 16 future scientists or poets. While all these were being treated at the infirmary and building repairs initiated, the gopher took the opportunity to leave.
I wonder if he is back at some gopher pub telling the story of, did you know what happened to me one time?
That story could have come right out of Caddyshack.
And that's the one. That's the urban legend.
But that's the story you started.
But if it were true, I would have known it. But since I didn't, it couldn't have been, unless it was, which meant that one of you, oh, which you wouldn't have, and yet you might have, and that proves my point.
That logic is so logical that it calls for another comparison. In Nazlet, a little village about 240 miles south from Cairo, Egypt, a chicken fell down a well. An 18-year-old farmer went down the well to retrieve him.
Let me interrupt. Did you know that all the water in Egypt, including the wells, is supplied by the Nile River? That's why if you take a cruise on the Nile River, there's a sign in the bathrooms that tell you not to throw the paper into the basin.
Thank you, Bob, for that information.
Thank you.
Also, since all the wells are connected to the Nile, a surge in the river could affect the water flow in any well and create an undercurrent, even if the well is some distance from the Nile River.
Which it apparently did. The farmer disappeared. The farmer's sister and two brothers went down looking for him, and they disappeared. Next were two elderly neighbors, just trying to help. Also gone. End result? One farmer, one sister, two brothers, and two neighbors removed from the gene pool. The chicken was rescued and is still laying eggs.
Now that's a true story. That really happened.
How do you know?
Because chickens can't swim.
Don't ask, Para.
I wasn't going to. Here's a story from Argentina. During a heated matrimonial argument in a middle-class neighborhood in Buenos Aires, a 25-year-old man picked up his 20-year-old wife and threw her off their eighth-story apartment balcony. Much to his displeasure, he missed the street. Instead, the lady became entangled in some power lines hanging below.
Now, his next move brings us to the Darwin Award. whether he was so angry with himself for throwing her into the lines instead of onto the street, or if he suddenly felt great remorse for what he had done and was going to attempt some heroic rescue, that will never be known. What he did was, seeing her hanging there, still alive and kicking, he jumped out the window after her. Now, his aim for jumping was as bad in one direction as his aim for throwing was in the other.
With his wife, he missed the street and hit the wires. With his jump, he missed the wires and hit the street. Up popped Darwin to award this very deserving individual. By the way, the wife managed to swing down to another balcony and was saved.
All right, end of stories. Which one is the urban legend?
I'm pretty sure that last story is true, and since you did this to us once before, I'm going to guess they were all true.
No, I don't think so. I think they're all urban legends. By the way, Kurt, you're wearing your kilts today.
What does his kilt have to do with that?
Well, I happen to know that Kurt is a steward, and the kilt he is wearing is a McGregor plaid. Anyone who would wear someone else's tartan would tell an urban legend.
Except I happen to know that there are McGregors on his mother's side, and the kilt is reversible.
That means some of the stories are true. Which one isn't? Wait a minute. How do you know that it's reversible? Did you peek?
Don't ask, don't tell.
Well, when are you going to tell me the answer?
Bob, do you know how to keep a turkey in suspense?
No. How?
Well, tell you how at the end of the program.
Are you worried about your diet? Many are, as health consciousness is a topic of major concern. So in 1972, the Oregon Health Department ran a study on the contents of peanut butter and discovered, now you may not want to listen to this, that the chunks in Hoodie's chunky peanut butter were in actuality rat droppings. Hoodie executives were sentenced to 10 days in jail.
Following, the U.S. Department of Agriculture got involved and passed new guidelines as to what was allowable foreign matter in certain food products. Here is a part of the new allowances. In 100 grams of peanut butter, 50 insect fragments or 2 rodent hairs allowed. In 100 grams of tomato juice, 10 fruit fly eggs. In an 8-ounce chocolate bar, 150 insect fragments.
A study at Ohio University in 2005 stated that Americans unintentionally eat 1 to 2 pounds of insect parts every year. I don't think I want to mention how many spiders we eat while sleeping.
Wouldn't that be great to put on a job resume? On my last job, I counted insect parts in candy bars.
Did the job pay well?
No, but I could eat all the chocolate I wanted.
Are you finished with your chocolate? Do you know the only English word that doesn't have a rhyme? Orange. How about that?
Good, Kurt. But then how about silver, purple, month, ninth, and pint?
Don't stop there. How about opus, dangerous, marathon, and... Oh, I ought to hate myself for this one, but I don't. How about discombobulate?
Good one, Para.
What? Wait a minute. What's so funny? I didn't even know what that last word means. Besides, it doesn't rhyme with orange.
You know, there's a trivia question making the rounds asking you to name 3 words that end with the letters G-R-Y. And it gives you angry and hungry and asks what the other one is. It's actually a trick question. There is no other word. There are just the 2.
Well, wait a minute. If you would allow for an old variant spelling, there is the word puggery. It is properly spelled P-U-G-G-A-R-E-E, or P-U-G-A-R-E-E, or even P-U-G-G-R-E-E. It means the net wrapping that went around the pith helmets that the English wore in India.
But that doesn't rhyme with orange either. But I do know when an orange isn't an orange.
When is an orange not an orange?
When you throw it up in the air and it comes down squash.
I think we need to get to bell time in a hurry. In the night before Christmas, the children dream of sugar plums. Did you know that sugar plums are just hard candies?
Did you know that Maryland has a state sport? It's jousting.
Did you know that in the movies, Humphrey Bogart never said, "Play it again, Sam"? Cary Grant never said, "Judy, Judy, Judy." And James Cagney never said, "You dirty rat."
And in the books, Sherlock Holmes never said, "Elementary, my dear Watson."
Did you know that Alfred Nobel, the founder of the Nobel Prize, made his fortune as the inventor of dynamite?
Did you know that Rhode Island never ratified the 18th Amendment establishing prohibition?
Did you know that Chinese fortune cookies were not invented in China and were originally served at the beginning of the meal to be used as an appetizer while the meal was coming?
That the Douglas fir tree isn't really a fir, it's a pine tree.
That Michelangelo created the only shopping list known to be a work of art. His cook couldn't read, so he drew a picture of wine, fruit, bread, and spaghetti.
That Goldilocks was originally named Silverhair.
That poison ivy isn't an ivy and poison oak isn't an oak. They are both members of the cashew family.
That in 1954, the National Cancer Institute said that if cigarette smoking actually plays a role in lung cancer, it seems to be a minor one.
That in 1845, Dr. Dionysius Lardner said that high-speed rail travel was impossible because people would not be able to breathe and would die of asphyxiation.
That before the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, Custer said, "I guess we'll get through them in a day."
That before the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, Napoleon said, "I tell you, Wellington is a bad general and the English are bad soldiers. We will settle this matter by lunchtime."
Now back to another Carolina story. Here is a quote from an early explorer when he first saw the region around Lake Waccamaw in Columbus County. He said, "This is the pleasantest place that ever I saw in my life. The lake is about 3.5 miles by 5 miles. Some years ago, a whale fossil was found in the lake, and there is an area on the eastern side called Indian's Mound, where, according to story, nothing will grow. It is believed, historically, to have been formed by meteorites, but the local story of its origin is much more fascinating."
According to Indian legend, many years ago there was no lake, but instead a mound of beautiful flowers. And taking care of the flowers was an Indian princess, who was the most beautiful princess that ever existed. The great spirits had entrusted her with the care of the flowers and given her a royal title of Keeper of the Wild Flowers. Every year at the beginning of the spring, the chiefs of all the neighboring tribes sent their eldest son to the princess for her blessing and the promise of a good fortune for the tribe for the following year.
As she greeted each of the warriors, she gave them a wild rose as a symbol of the promise. Well, for one warrior from the north, the rose was not enough. He wanted to marry the princess and keep her for himself. He asked the Waccamaw chief, but was told that the Great Spirit had decreed that as Keeper of the Wild Flowers, she was not permitted to wed. Her service was just to the Great Spirit.
This answer infuriated the warrior from the north, so he went home and gathered the rest of his warriors and returned to destroy the garden and kill the Waccamaw braves. The Keeper of the Wild Flowers hid in the swamps as she watched her beautiful flowers destroyed.
She cried out to the Great Spirit to allow her to die also, and to fill the area with the water that never again would men be able to destroy such beauty. As she fell to the ground, the mound, now desolate, sank, and in its place appeared the waters of Lake Waccamaw.
Did you know that Susan Shulkin, a student at Waccamaw Academy, composed a poem about this legend, and it was printed in the spring 1978 edition of The Tar Heel Junior Historian? Way long time ago lived an Indian princess whose home was a mound of flowers tall. This maid was a comely, a beauty she was, and her name was Waccamaw. She tended the garden and taught all the tribes of the lore of the Great Spirit of Manitou. So Manitou blessed her, guarded and kept her, shielded her heart from sorrow. Now far to the north of the beautiful land lived the savage tribe of the Black Bear Claw. The prince of this tribe loved the pretty young maiden, whose name was Waccamaw. "Oh, dear Princess Hashpo, I shan't be your wife, for by oath I am bound to Manitou. I've pledged not to marry. This garden's my life." "Dear Hashpo, it mustn't be so." Her words sparked his anger and kindled his wrath. He cursed the garden by the Black Bear Claw. His warriors then Hashpo led off to war against the tribe called Waccamaw. The maiden saw the slaughter of her dear tribe and prayed from her heart to Manitou. Dear spirit, let me die now and let my mound sink into a lake of waters low. The sun it descends on a lone sandbank. 'Tis the grave of the princess fair and small. And where her mound once stood is a lake, and its name is Whack-A-Maw.
It's answer time for the urban legend, and that last piece of inside history doesn't count. One of them is not an award winner, but which one is it? My guess is the rhinoceros.
Likewise, Jim would take his mother for her test, and after the farmer disappeared down the well, others would go after him. I voted for the rhinoceros.
And some Caddyshack wannabe would take a gopher into the back room and douse him. I also vote for the rhinoceros.
Let me check my kilt for the right answer. Good job. The rhinoceros story was the urban legend.
What side of the kilt did he look on?
I didn't ask.
But I'll tell, the right side.
Since the British drive differently than we do, is that the right side or the proper side?
The side that gave the right answer.
Which was the proper thing to do.
I wonder what it says on the other side.
It says that the initial presentations of Did You Know occur Thursdays at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8, with podcasts available after the initial broadcast.
And it says the Trongerated Reading Service can provide a sub-channel receiver to anyone who is print and visually impaired. All they have to do is call 832-5138.
It also says that if you would be willing to help support the special programming of TRRS and our ability to provide sub-channel receivers to those who are print and visually impaired, all you have to do is call 832-5138.
And it says you can hear our program on the Internet by going to triangleradioservice.org.
Just click on the Listen Now prompt on the navigation bar.
All that inside a kilt?
Wait a minute. Yes, it does.
How do you know it says all that?
Don't ask, don't tell.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. And did you know where a 1,000-pound gorilla sleeps? Anywhere he wants to.
And this is Paul Tolson. Please call us and tell us what you like about our show at 919-832-5138. And did you know what you get when you cross an elephant with a greeting card? Well, if you give it to your husband, you'll get a spouse who never forgets your anniversary and your birthday.
And this is Bob Martin. And did you know what is green, orange, and red with six legs and four wings and a great big set of teeth? Well, I don't know what it's called, but right now, one is sitting on Potter's shoulder.
That was a piece of jewelry.
Oh, so sorry. Well, now you have a pair of them. I'm not going to say anything, but there's another pair on another shoulder, and they're moving.
Goodbye.